In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a fascinating chat with Susan Shaheen, Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering and the Co-Director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Susan and I chat about her interest in the nexus of technology, human behavior, and public policy, and how the US Smart Cities Challenge sparked her interest in this space when she was involved in San Francisco's application. We discuss how pivotal and galvanizing that grant was for many cities around America, and how the community engagement framework that they used for the San Francisco application really valued a co-creation model between public, private, and the community. Susan then tells us about some of the projects she's been working on, including some research documenting the learnings from the cities of their experience of the Smart Cities Challenge. She tells us some of the takeaways from the research, including the four categories of smart cities or communities that they uncovered, plus the importance of not relying solely on champions for long-term sustainability of smart projects. We finish our chat discussing the emerging focus on social equity and social justice in smart communities to help solve systematic problems, plus some of Susan's favorite resources. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the Smart Community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Susan. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
That's awesome to hear. Let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Yeah. So I'm a professor in civil and environmental engineering and co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. And I've been interested in the social and environmental impacts of technology on transportation, specifically people's behavior, behavioral economics, as well as public policy. And kind of I am most passionate about the nexus of those three things. So behavior, technology, and policy. And I have a PhD in ecology, focusing on the energy and environmental aspects of transportation. So kind of a little bit more on the engineering side.
Yeah, wow. Sounds super interesting and so many things coming together there. Something I'm really passionate about as well is how we can, you know, create a network, a transport network that's sustainable in all senses of the word and using technology to do so. So I'm so keen to jump into a little bit of that. So this is the Smart Community Podcast. So we talk a lot about, you know, communities, technology, all those different types of things. So tell us what sparked your interest specifically in the area that that you're working in with in the environment, technology, and transport.
Yeah, well, so specifically, I got really involved in smart cities, which I think is very closely related to the idea of smart communities in around 2015. There was a big US DOT, Department of Transportation, challenge grant issued. And it was, you know, one of those moonshot ideas and opportunities that US DOT released. And it was a total of $50 million to the grand winner. And I was part of a team between the city of San Francisco that teamed with UC Berkeley to be one of the bidders. And in total, there were 78 applicants who applied, and the city of San Francisco made it into the finals. And so during that time frame, it was basically such a deep immersion into what is a smart city and how were we defining smart city in terms of our approach to it in the San Francisco Bay Area. So it was a super exciting time. And ever since then, I've been really fascinated by the idea of smart cities and smart communities.
No, that's awesome. And yeah, I went to Columbus earlier this year. Yes, it was. Feels like ages ago. In January. and visited that team, the Smart Columbus team.
So yeah, they won the grand prize.
Yeah, but I mean, I found when I talk to people, particularly those that are working closely in smart city space in America, that grant was really a pivotal point for a lot of people, right? And even if people didn't win, they immersed themselves in the smart city space. And I think it really did a good job of kind of bringing that smart city concept to the foreground, but then also getting cities thinking about it. Because I've read a few of the different bids, and even though if they didn't get the money, they were able to implement some of, or at least they had a strategy there and that type of thing, like Denver, for example. So yeah, it was really interesting. Keen to your thoughts on that, like how that kind of came about and what it did for the cities in America.
Oh, I think it galvanized a lot of people to think about what do we mean by smart city and how did each of the cities that were thinking about this characterize it and how might they be similar and might they be different? And it, I think, really caused the acceleration of thinking around this area, and that you didn't have to be some big city in order to be a smart city or a city that is embracing technology in a way that reflects the goals and objectives of the community. And so that's exactly right. It was really intense. I'll tell you, as somebody that was part of one of the teams that were in the finals, it was fast and furious. We had to work really hard. We had to work across silos, both vertically and horizontally. And we had to come up with really big, ambitious ideas. And $50 million is a lot of money, particularly matched by the private sector. And so coming up with a strategic plan for how to spend those dollars, how to involve the community in co-creating the pilot projects as well as the private sector, and then how to evaluate it was something that all of us had to think really long and hard about. So a lot of cities got organized, and a lot of cities that didn't make it into the finals watched the finalists go forward, and that galvanized them to go forward with their plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so interesting. Okay, well, let's go to, well, what is a smart city or a smart community to you?
Yeah, well, to me, what I learned from that whole process was that it's really about people. It's really about what the goals and objectives of a community are and really embracing that with the community itself. So to me, it's really a smart community that reflects its people. Mm-hmm. And before that, I had heard smart city used a lot as terminology, and I had a vision of it being much more about technology and the movement of electrons, for example, you know, to cause a city to be fully connected. And so to me, it was more about technology and wireless than it was about people. And now my view is that first and foremost, it's about people and their goals and objectives and what role technology can play in that.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that this concept is really important?
Well, I think it's really important because technology is part of where we're all going, and it's coming really at a faster rate than it was even 10 years ago. So thinking about how to integrate it into our communities is essential, and having a mindset that focuses on what the community really wants to do with technology. And if it wants to emphasize, for example, social equity, and instead of just technology leaving a divide, a digital and an income divide, but instead using technology to close the gaps, to provide social and racial equity, I think it provides us with an opportunity to really think about that very carefully before technology creates even more divides than are currently there.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really important, because when I talk, you know, I talk to a lot of people about this, it's coming at us thick and fast, whether we like it or not, and whether we're involved or not. But if we want social good and we want, you know, technology to be used for public good, then we have to get involved, because otherwise those divides will just get bigger and bigger, because the private sector, although has a massive role in this, they're not always thinking about public good, right? Because they have to be sustainable as a business. And I think that's where, you know, the government and academia and, you know, we have to come together to be able to make a smart community actually work well for everybody. And if it doesn't work well for everyone, then we have to keep going. We're not, you know, I don't think we'll ever get to this final goal of, okay, cool, now we're a smart city, okay, we're done, and close the door. Like, I think it's a mindset and a framework and a way of thinking rather than an end goal is the way I look at it.
And I think companies would love to know how cities want technology used, as opposed to necessarily going in and defining it for a city. That's one of the things that I learned through the process with San Francisco, and then in working on smart cities with many other cities over the last 3 years. I think a lot of the companies are like, tell us what you want. You know, when you think about bringing in, for example, an automated vehicle or a shared automated vehicle system, tell us what your community wants to do with that technology, as opposed to expecting us to provide the roadmap for where your city should go with that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And yeah, something I've seen as well, it's this, like, nobody has all the answers, right? But the private sector has some parts of the answers. The government has so much information that needs to be used to be able to, you know, enact these smart communities. But the community has, you know, all of the answers that we need, right? We just need to give them the tools to be able to tell us what it is and what it isn't. And I think that, yeah, there has been a mismatch in the past where we've probably relied on the private sector to not only provide the solution, but tell us why there's a problem in the first place, which, you know, isn't the way that we need to operate and move forward. And I think maybe it's worked in the past, but potentially maybe not. But I think now it has to be with the community. And I think it, as much as we can talk about stakeholder engagement and all these types of things, we're not doing enough of it. And I think the amount that we need to do will shock people, because we haven't done it like that before. But if we invest in that, then I think there is a direct correlation to the amount of engagement that we are doing and the success of the project, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, the San Francisco application had a really involved community engagement framework that someone led from the mayor's office. And it was going to include essentially challenge grants to neighborhoods in San Francisco who came together to basically define what they wanted done from a mobility standpoint. And they could potentially win grant money to have these pilots done in their communities. And we didn't get to actually implement it, but it was a really inspiring process to see, you know, how the mayor's office was viewing the importance of community and neighborhood engagement in terms of defining problems they wanted solved, mm-hmm. and co-creating the solutions or strategies with the private sector and with government. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about, is a much more creative and involved process for seeing what communities want.
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's interesting, like when I was in America earlier this year talking to mayors, I was fortunate enough to go to a conference and I spoke at a mayor's roundtable, and there's some really visionary, innovative people in there. It's just so amazing. And a lot of it is from this, you know, the DOT grant, right? Because they've heard that someone else was doing it and they want a piece of that as well. And what they need is those enthusiastic people, passionate people, talented people underneath them that to then actually enact this. But it really does start at the top and having a mayor that believes this is possible. So I think a lot of the time, we get stuck in impossible thinking where it's like, oh, well, this is the way it is, and we have to catch ourselves out. Like, I think we don't even realize that we're thinking like that necessarily. But then when we step into this, you know, okay, this could be possible. And if you've got a mayor that's like, this is possible and I want it for my community, then you're starting out on a good kind of run. Whereas, but if you don't have that at the top, but you also need the support from the bottom, then it's never going to
It was amazing when we worked on the San Francisco application, how much Mayor Ed Lee, who was the mayor at the time of San Francisco, how deeply invested he was in this and his staff. It was amazing to see. And then when we all came together for the final presentations to the evaluation committees, there was an event at the very end where each of the cities presented a video, which you might have seen online. And they were shown, and Secretary Fox came, and all of the mayors were there. And they all stood on stage and talked about how proud they were of their teams and the applications. And it was really an amazing process. I really haven't participated in anything like that before. And I think you're totally right. The mayors were so visionary.
Mm, and I think it makes it real. I think that's a big part of it, because particularly here in Australia, we have so many amazing pockets of innovation happening and smart city things happening. But until it's seen to be real, you won't get everyone on board. Whereas when, you know, and we've had some smart cities and suburbs grants come out as well. That were $50 million in total. So it was, and that's Australian dollars. So it was split up between the different councils. You know, you had to apply and all that type of stuff. But I think if we could have something big and bold and really, I guess, drive this concept home, then I think we could have a similar effect to what America has had in moving accelerating the smart city movement.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about you now. I want to know about your work and what you've been up to lately and what projects and things you've been working on.
Yeah, well, so what one thing I wanted to make sure you were aware of is we came together after the Smart City Challenge with basically the gentleman from USDOT who was leading the effort on behalf of Secretary Fox, and his name is Mark Dowd. And so we did a project with Mr. Dowd after he left the administration. Mm-hmm. And he's now the Chief Innovation Officer for Metro in New York City, by the way. But we did this project together, basically documenting the Smart City Challenge understanding from the 2016-2015 competition, but also he went on to create a laboratory and expanded the network of smart cities, you know, well beyond the initial, you know, 10 or so to more than 20. In fact, there is a huge network all the way across Texas. And so we did a project where we documented the learnings from essentially about 3 years of deep dive experience in these cities, in which we were working with the teams that were part of the Smart City Challenge, but then other cities that wanted to go forward with these ideas and were definitely galvanized by their mayors. And so the key takeaways from that are quite fascinating, including just this notion that if you're going to do this, it has to be about people. It has to be about the problems that they need solved. It can't be driven by a technological vision in the absence of people. And I think the other really big key takeaway for us is that in order for a smart city and a smart community to be successful, it definitely needs a champion, but it can't fall apart if that champion, for example, leaves the organization. So this philosophy has to be more deeply embedded throughout an organization, and it can't be siloed in an organization. And it's got to cross boundaries between, say, different arms of the government. And without that, you know, you might create a pilot, but at the end of the day, that pilot may not be sustainable from a business standpoint, an economic standpoint, and from a social standpoint. So a lot of what we took away was just the importance of this very integrated approach being central to the concept of a smart city or a smart community.
Mm. Yeah, that is so true. And they talk about in Australia here, there's some research done around, like innovation districts. And it's a similar thing where, you know, they might last about 18 months if they only have the one champion, because that's how long it takes someone to burn out or leave an organization. I talk a lot about why I did a Winston Churchill Fellowship, which means I traveled around the world and looked at smart mobility in 9 different countries. And one of the things that I took out of that was the governance approach, which, you know, isn't the sexy part of smart cities at all, but actually giving people a team or a head, what I call a headspace, so you can have a headspace to actually be able to come up with these things away from business as usual. And that might be how it starts. But then if we don't infiltrate it back in, if we're just creating another silo, oh, well, this is the smart city silo, I don't think about this unless I'm in that team, then it's not going to work. And like you said, we'll have pilot after pilot, but actually it won't be embedded into the community or the city or the region that we're working with. So yeah, thanks so much for sharing that, because I think it's something we probably don't talk about enough, that we get caught up, I think, a lot around, you know, what the technology can do and where it's at now and when, you know, this is going to be ubiquitous or when we're going to have autonomous vehicles. But if we don't have that integration and collaboration within an organization and then external as well, like, because I think we operate in silos, not only externally, so we have, this is government, even different government agencies not talking to each other. But then internally in those government agencies, or not even government, private sector, whatever, then we're not talking to each other. And I think a lot of the time it's that it's not given the value isn't realized of that cross collaboration until we really need it. And it doesn't just happen by accident either. And I think that it has to be intentional. And I think that's where, if we're not intentional about it, then we can't, it just doesn't happen by accident. And I think that's a really key part in this whole smart community thing, but probably doesn't get the credit that it, or the value, or the focus it deserves as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I think another thing I wanted to share with you is that when we worked together on this report, we looked across a lot of cities because, you know, Mark's leadership grew this network pretty broadly. And so we ended up looking across the experiences of all of these cities that were embracing this idea, and basically came up with some type of a typology of defining types of smart cities and regions. And for the ones that we were working with throughout the US, we developed 4 categories. And I don't know if you've ever heard of these types of frameworks before, but there were the tech-oriented cities and regions, and often these were the cities that were driven by technological innovation. And they were cities like Seattle and San Francisco, for example. And they often focused on things like housing affordability and the high cost of living. Also, the really difficulty in mobility, like just getting from one side of the city to the next to get your child, for example, from school to a piano lesson or to a doctor's appointment, was something that we found were massive mobility challenges for people working and living in some of these environments. We also found that there were a lot of cities, including Columbus, that we might categorize more as economic revival cities and regions. So these are cities where their economies had slowed down, and they were looking at smart cities as a way of reinventing their regional economies and leveraging smart city strategies to work on economic development and respond to things like, you know, social equity and workforce development. And actually, I want to go back and just make sure I say that, you know, it wasn't that San Francisco wasn't focused on equity. In fact, all the cities have been focused on equity, but I think with these economic revival cities, there are sometimes serious issues associated with employment that had to be addressed. And so examples of those kind of cities were Detroit and Pittsburgh and Columbus. We also saw growth cities, and those were places that are growing economically and spatially. And they tend to have fewer challenges associated with housing affordability, but instead are often focused on managing their growth because they're under construction a lot. And some really good examples of that, I think you might have mentioned one, is Denver, and then also Houston, Texas. And then we've also found in the fourth category, both small and rural communities that have challenges associated with retaining talent. People want to go to the bigger cities. And so oftentimes they're thinking about how do they retain their residents and invest in placemaking and how they can go about doing that to discourage people from relocating to larger cities. An example of that is College Station in Texas. So that was something that I thought was really fascinating that came out of this work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I really enjoy looking across the different cities, regions, rural areas, and looking at those common threads. So then we can pick up, because not, you know, everywhere's not going to be the same, right? Obviously. But we can actually look at those common threads and then bring those things into places where we go, well, actually across, you know, these areas, and they're focused on whatever, if we can pinpoint those, then we can use those features, lessons, whatever they are, to then implement those in other cities that, you know, may have some of the same similar characteristics or want to follow in the path of certain areas. And that's what I've been looking at a lot. Obviously, when I went around and had a look at different places, I was specifically focused on transportation and mobility. But then, yeah, looking here in Australia, because a lot of the time when I talk to councils, particularly ones who are at the very start of their journey, it's, well, tell me what platform do I need to buy, or what does it look like at the end? And I think that's where, you know, if you can actually, and there's no exact answer for that, because we want to amplify what makes this place, right? We want to amplify Houston to be Houston, not some other form of, you know, we don't want it to be Seoul. We don't want it to be Silicon Valley. We don't want it to be Barcelona. We want it to be Houston, and people want to go there because it's Houston. So you're amplifying those strengths. And sometimes you're amplifying what may have been considered a weakness, but you're shifting it or you're changing it, and you're making choices through different ways of thinking and technology. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, what I found kind of exciting about it is that when you have this big network of smart cities and they're addressing new challenges, for example, during this time frame when we were working on our big study together, micromobility came about, you know, the shared dockless scooters and shared dockless bikes, right? And they were appearing everywhere. And this network of cities was able to work together on creating policy strategies for, you know, how to manage the arrival of these modes. And it is helpful, right? If they have understanding of, well, you're a small size city, what are you doing? We're also a small size city. Or you're a higher tech city, how are you addressing these regulations and policies? And so I think the framing is also really helpful, particularly when technology arrives and cities are trying to figure out what to do, right? Is one size does not fit all, right? And so what kinds of policies are used in one location may be vastly different than another, and may be more likely to reflect land use in the built environment and the population densities. And so that was something that was really neat to see, is we actually developed, as part of a second study, a micromobility toolkit, and got a lot of feedback from this smart city network that was real time dealing with how do we develop permitting practices, how many vehicles should be allowed into the system? How do we deal with social equity? How do we deal with enforcement? How do we deal with curb management issues? And it was really cool to see how the city sort of co-created, but they also had understanding of how to position themselves based on what other cities they related to more based on size and land use.
It's so interesting. And I think that's what we need more of, because I think a lot of cities and regions and rural areas, particularly speaking from Australia, feel very, I guess, alone in this because they're like, well, you know, I have very specific issues and I also don't want to be the one to say, I don't know what to do, or I'm not involved yet, or I don't know anything about technology, so I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be made a fool or whatever in a conversation. And I think that's where and why I shifted to the language of smart communities, is because when I said smart city, particularly for the community, that the general public, they had no idea what I was talking about and didn't engage with that terminology. And so I shifted to communities, one, because I was speaking a lot in regional areas and working in regional areas, and I live in a regional area myself. And so city is nearly a swear word the further, you know, out you go. And you know, people think cities, buildings, you know, is very hard infrastructure. Whereas when I said community, even though they didn't really know what the smart thing was, potentially, they could go, oh, well, I've got a smartphone, a community. Okay, I know what a community is. Okay. And then you'd start, they'd ask questions, right? Not everyone likes the term smart, but I haven't found anything better, and it's what it is at the moment. But, and that's when I started to get that engagement with real community members, the people that we're working for, right? And that's what I got really excited. I'm like, oh, right, okay, now I can actually have these conversations. And it makes it about people. Because as soon as you say community, people think people. Yeah, so it's really interesting. And I think we can learn so much from each other, America and Australia, because we have some of those, particularly the rural areas that European cities don't necessarily have as much of. But in saying that, we can learn from everybody. And that's where I wanted to kind of go across different boundaries in not just going to places. So I went to, you know, I went to Mexico and I went to South Africa. I went to Seoul. I went to Europe, America. And I wanted to see what people were doing the same, even though they would say they're completely different. And then what things are different based on the context. So yeah, really, really interesting. I think we can learn so much from each other. And I think that's where these frameworks and toolkits can be really, really useful, because it's not prescribing everything, but it gives you ideas of where to start and, you know, a set of guidelines to use, which a lot of the time is what people need to kind of get on the runway and get going with this stuff.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Really interesting. I like, it was around this time last year, no, just before, I went from March to May, and I was thinking about, like, basically when COVID restrictions came in Australia was the day that I left the year before. And so I was just like, oh my God, I wouldn't have been able to go anywhere with the current climate. But then it shows how much things can change. And I think that's where it's really enforced in me that this smart city concept, smart community concept is so important, because if we don't have that basic level of digital literacy, digital infrastructure, and I guess the connectivity, then people are left so far behind that it's really hard to catch up. And we saw it here in Australia where we had that divide, it just exploded, because particularly when we went on school online and those type of things, if, you know, people didn't have a device or weren't comfortable using it or didn't have internet, maybe only had 1 gig of data because that was fine at the time. And so it's really instilled in me that this stuff is so important, and that we need to, you know, unfortunately it took COVID to kind of shine a huge spotlight on it. But now I'm hoping that we'll see further and further investment and real investment too, right? And, you know, I think everything has its place. We need public awareness. We need to show off some technology so people know what's possible. But the stuff that really excites me is where we can enact, you know, new policy, or we can really get in deep with the community to actually understand what it is they need and what it is they don't want as well. And I think particularly in regional rural areas, we can really transform some of these places. And we've seen some transformations here in America has as well, when things, you know, have been ripped out, you know, like certain industries or whatever, but then we come back with a community concept where we can actually, now there are places that people want to go rather than just being struck off the map. Anyway, I'm talking too much. I want to know, we're going to wrap up very soon, but what are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about?
Well, you know, I don't think this is an emerging trend, but I personally want to talk about it a lot more. So I'm going to use my time to talk about it, and that's social equity and social justice. And, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about this in the U.S. over the last month or so, and we really just need to continue this conversation. And I think it's a moment, right? Just like COVID has been a moment, as you mentioned, to sort of galvanize change and to think differently about smart communities and technology. I think we've also, seen a lot of social unrest in this country, and we saw it rise up around the world as well, around racism. And I think we really have to think long and hard about how we're going to solve this and how we're going to learn to talk about it. And I think it's got to start all the way at the school level and work its way all the way up to the policy and technology level. And so I'm hoping maybe it's more than an emerging trend. It's just becoming part of our DNA. But I've been really frustrated for a while now in that I've been studying technology cities and in pilot programs for probably a good 25 years, and was always hopeful that I would see some changes happening in the socio-demographics of the users, people who could really benefit from access, for example, to a shared car or access to just advanced technology to help them with their ladders of opportunity. And over time, study after study, I see maybe a little shift in the socio-demographics of the users, but by and large, we have a digital and an income divide. And I think unless we put our minds to fixing this and to talking about it, it's going to be with us, and it's going to be potentially baked into the cake with artificial intelligence and machine learning. Mm. So I can talk to you a lot about this topic.
I maybe we need to do another podcast on that, because I find it also something that needs to be spoken about, particularly and not separate to smart communities, because it can't be, because for me, that's the future, and the future that is diverse, that is inclusive, that is human. Yeah. But it can't be if all we're doing is increasing those divides, or, you know, making access easier for people that already had access. We need to think about not the customers we have right now and today, but what are the potential customers we could have, and how would that actually change their lives, rather than it making it easier to get to and from work for somebody who already could access that. And I think, and that's something I talked about a lot in my fellowship. It was like, well, okay, an autonomous vehicle is great, whatever, but if it's an autonomous Audi that makes the people that already have enough money, now they can make more money because they don't have to drive anymore and can be even more productive. That's great, but that's not something I want to be. That's not interesting to me. What's interesting to me is if we could, and not even autonomous technology necessarily, but connected technology, or even just focusing in on the real issues that are complex and that we could actually start to solve. Because an autonomous vehicle, for example, when we do talk about increasing accessibility, all of the things that it could do, which is, you know, the increase in accessibility, is to get from A to B or C to D or whatever. And that is available right now. You can hire a van, or you can make a public transport route, and that could solve that issue. The autonomous part of it isn't solving the issue. And so I think that's where we need to couple together, well, what is the actual issue we're trying to solve? And then look at, well, how can we do this differently if it's not working now? And that's where I see that if we can start having those conversations, then the smart community concept will be baked into the future of communities and actually be used to solve some of these really wicked problems that we have to do with social issues and injustices and that divide that we're seeing over and over again. Maybe we should do a whole podcast on this.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I can talk about it for a really long time because I just think that it's so nuanced and challenging to get at. And it's just something we need to study more and to talk about more and to really apply careful and thoughtful thinking to. Mm. And so I've been talking about it as much as I can in my talks or, you know, in podcasts like this, because I just think it's something that we need to elevate, you know, because we're always elevating technology, right? It's this concept that everybody sort of gets excited about, right? It's change and it's potentially sexy, right? Seductive in some ways, right? That, you know, we can solve all these problems with it. But the thing is that if you just layer technology on existing systemic problems, you're not going to solve those problems with technology.
Yeah, I like that way of putting it, because I think that's something we do attempt to do quite often. And I think the other thing is, once we start, like you said, it's a focus, it's like engagement. The other thing, actually, before I say that, is then we need to bring in the people that we're trying to solve these problems for, right? And that's where the engagement comes in. And I think that's where we need to see radical engagement or radical change in the way that we engage. In the sense of radical, as in it's very different to what it was before. It's, you know, there's lots of it. We have different people. It's diverse. It's a new way of thinking about how we can bring in those people, because we need to meet people where they're at if we really want to make change and not just tick a box. So, but yeah, the focus is so important. We need to focus in on these things. And for me, what COVID showed me is that when we focus and when we see that there's a big issue, then we can make change quickly, and we can learn, and we can have honest conversations, and we can do these things because we have been told or that it is a necessary thing to do. So once we focus in on these things, then I think we can see real change. But maybe I'm a naive millennial or an optimist, but I feel like we can definitely, and we have to. It's something that we can't just let happen, because the future of our communities has to be different to the ones we saw in the past.
Yeah, you know, and it kind of brings us full circle to the beginning of our conversation about, you know, what is a smart community, right? And it's about people. But if we don't engage people, how are we ever going to create something that's sustainable and smart? Mm-hmm. And so the engagement has got to be different.
Okay, finally, I have one quick question around smart community resources. So give us a list of some of your favorite smart city, smart community resources that you look at on the daily, or some of the things that you've been involved in. And we'll put those links in the show notes.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the resources that I'm really excited about and actively engaged in using myself is the resources provided by the National Association of City Transportation Officials, NACTO. I don't know if you came across them when you visited the US.
Yes, I wasn't able to visit them, but yes, I know of them.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it represents, I think, more of a US perspective, but it is this network of cities. And they put out a lot of really great guidance documents. They just put one out around curb management, for example, because that's like a big issue these days, right? Before COVID, lots of focus on micromobility management and the curb. Potentially, how do we evolve the curb as a result of automated vehicles? And then with COVID, just this rapid shifting of the demand for the curb for e-commerce and goods delivery. Not that that wasn't there before, but it did become an increasing focus. And also with COVID, the movement towards slow streets and just re-examining infrastructure and parking. So great resource there. Another group that I've worked really closely with is the Smart Cities Lab. And that's that network of cities approach that I mentioned coming out of the USD DOT Smart City Challenge. Another one that's really, I think, pretty exciting is the Texas Innovation Alliance, which is essentially a network of local, regional, and state agencies, you know, really working throughout the state of Texas and really creating that network effect that we were talking about so that it's not a city feeling like it's an island in and of itself, but actually they have a network of cities that they can turn to address questions.
Yeah, I've had Jennifer on the podcast and I absolutely love talking to her. And she, the Dallas Alliance, I'm going to get the name wrong, but yes, it was awesome. Okay, that's awesome. Thanks so much for sharing those. And yes, I love digging into good resources because I find a lot are surface level. And so when there's some, you know, ones with substance that are doing real stuff, I love it. I just have one last question, and it's been so great to chat with you. And I think we could speak for hours and hours, and we'll have to have another conversation soon for sure. But yeah, the last question is, how can people connect with you?
So I think social media is great. You can connect with me via Twitter. My handle is Susan Shaheen One. So it's just my first name, no space, and last name, S-H-A-H-E-E-N, and then just a one. And also on LinkedIn, just my name, Susan Shaheen. And I'm often posting. I have a weekly Innovative Mobility Highlights newsletter that I post on both those formats. And you can always Google me and get my email address at UC Berkeley as well.
Excellent. Thanks so much. And yes, I've been following along your posts. And we'll put all those links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. Thank you again for having this great conversation with me. And I really look forward to our next conversation.
My pleasure. Yeah, let's definitely knock a podcast out on social equity.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm thinking, because I've had a lot of chats with people around this topic. So I'm thinking like maybe a panel podcast or something. I don't know.
Okay. Count me in.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Now I have to organize it. Okay. Thanks. So much, Susan. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Have a great rest of the day.
Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.